This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Steve Martin is still best known for comedy, but he's very good in his dramatic role in David Mamet's current film, The Spanish Prisoner. On this archive edition, we have an interview with Steve Martin focusing on his early years. Steve Martin first became known as a stand-up comic and as a popular guest host on Saturday Night Live. His films include The Jerk, Roxanne, Pennies from Heaven, All of Me, Parenthood, and Father of the Bride. He wrote the screenplays for The Jerk and Roxanne. He also writes for the stage. In 1996, he told me that when he was young, his family moved a couple of miles away from what became Disneyland in Anaheim, California. I asked him how old he was when Disneyland opened.
10. And it's so funny. I just got a Diane Arbus photograph of the Magic Castle at Disneyland that was taken in 1955. And I used to stand in front of this little spot in front of the Magic Castle and sell the Disneyland news when I was 10. And there's the swans in the moat, and the swans I seem to remember. You know, I knew those particular swans. And there was something perfect in the merging of Diane Arbus and this, fantasy family place. And she brought out the kind of surrealism of it, and it was a perfect image for me. So I wake up to it every day.
that's great. Now, how did you gravitate to Disneyland? I mean, I'm not sure how much meaning Disney had for you at the time. You were maybe too old for the Mickey Mouse Club, and I don't know if Mickey Mouse, the cartoon character, meant anything.
I liked the idea of dressing up in gay 90s clothes and working at Disneyland.
That was the uniform, so to speak, that you wore to sell the Disney news?
Yeah, sell the Disneyland news. And then I did all kinds of things. That's where I really got my start in show business, because when I was about 15, I got a job in a magic shop there demonstrating card tricks. And I got to stand up in front of people and make them laugh, and it was very interesting. And then I moved over to Knott's Berry Farm, where they did a melodrama theater. And I performed in that for about 3 years while I was going to college.
So you learned...
And then I did this interview.
The rest is history.
Yeah.
I read that you met a vaudevillian in Disneyland also, mm-hmm. who influenced you. Who was that?
Well, his name was Wally Bogue, and he worked at the Pepsi Golden Horseshoe Review, it was called. And he was a very funny guy. And he did balloon animals, but he had a great sense of humor, and it was very clean, and it was crisp. And I used to watch the show endlessly, hoping, of course, that he would get sick, and they would say, is there an 11-year-old who could possibly fill in for Wally?
You know, it's interesting as an 11-year-old that you related to this vaudevillian kind of act, because it was from another era.
Well, this would have been about 1956, 57. So the era wasn't so far gone.
Right, these guys were still on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Who?
Guys like that were still on the Ed Sullivan Show on
sure,
TV
absolutely.
All the time.
Yeah, it didn't matter the style of performing. It was just the idea of being funny and getting up there at that point. When you're 11, you're not thinking about style. You're thinking about stealing.
Were there things that he was doing that you really imagined yourself doing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know what you mean. He would tell jokes and do balloons.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, which you did. Yeah. You went to college and majored in philosophy, dropped out after 3 years. Let's start with a philosophy.
Well, actually, it was 4 years.
But 4 years.
I changed my major when I was a senior.
Uh-huh.
And
changed it to or from philosophy?
From philosophy to theater.
Oh.
And then I got a job writing for the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, and I quit.
Why did you major in philosophy?
I met a girl when I was 18, and we fell in love in that sort of 18-year-old way. And she was very enthusiastic about knowledge and learning, and she made me read The Razor's Edge, and I got all excited about studying philosophy. And I'm glad I did.
I wonder if you think philosophy has helped you with writing comedy at all. I mean, if you've ever, because I think you have kind of applied some of the, you know, logic of philosophy toward mm-hmm. toward humor in making fun of it or deconstructing it.
Yeah, I think it has helped me quite a bit. And just, I can't tell you why, but I feel it's still being used. And yet, if you ask me, you know, to give the philosophy of Hegel, I would have a hard time remembering. But certain, it's just a, gave me concepts that I've used my whole life.
Can you think of a particular sketch or something you used to do in your stand-up act that you felt really had a direct connection to what you read?
Not really, but I did understand that that you know absurdism came into my act quite a bit. So I think that somehow that was linked to philosophy because it was always denying the truth or making leaps to things that weren't logical or it's hard to remember all these things. And if I did, it wouldn't be that interesting, you know, to say, well, yes, this was based on Aristotle's, you know.
That's right.
Because they're not. They're just based on trying to make people laugh, and that's what came out.
But I am into the intellectual thing. I went to college. I studied the great philosophers, Socrates. I studied Plato. You know, you learn the important things. Like, if you're studying geology, which is all facts, as soon as you get out of school, you forget it all, you know? Because it's just numbers and things. But philosophy, you remember just enough to screw you up for the rest of your life. Then you study the important, like, ethical questions. Is it okay to yell movie in a crowded firehouse? Religious questions. Does the Pope shit in the woods? And keep waiting sometime, you know. Oh. If there is a God, give me a sign. See, I told you that the
Now, when you started writing for the Smothers Brothers, were you already doing stand-up yourself?
Yes, I was. I was doing stand-up, and this is another, my whole life is sectioned off into girlfriends, really, because I was dating a girl who was a dancer on the Smothers Brothers show, and we kind of broke up, and then she started dating the head writer. And at the time, this would be about 1967, it was very, very hip to be under 30. So they said, we want all writers under 30. So there I was. I was 21 years old, and I submitted some things I'd written, and they hired me. And actually, Mason Williams was the head writer, and he was, I found out later, was very generous and hired me and paid me out of his own pocket.
Wow.
For the first summer that I worked there, and then I was hired on.
What was your stand-up comedy like back in your early 20s?
It was essentially what I did in the late 70s. It was, you know, it had all that same shape, and it was but I used to read poems, you know, I used to actually play the banjo seriously, and it was a little bit of everything. It was the kitchen sink idea. And then I started to have a better understanding of what I was doing, and I made some decisions about what I was going to do, and that shaped it even further in the 70s before it just sort of broke out.
What kinds of decisions?
Well, you know, we were just coming out of the war era, and everyone had really long hair and was very, very serious. And I decided that it was time for something ridiculous. And I cut my hair, and I was determined to be the first person to cut their hair. And I put on a suit and went out on stage and started being really, really stupid. And it was just the right time to do that because everyone was so earnest and smart and philosophical and hating everyone. And it was just the right time for someone to be happy.
So it took the philosophy major to figure this out, be stupid on stage.
I don't know. Yeah, right.
Were you ever uncomfortable off stage with your short haircut when everybody else had their hair long?
No. No, it wasn't. And when I say short, it was relatively short.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was, I mean, look at pictures today and think, gee, my hair was really, really long. But that was the, you know, philosophy then.
My guest is Steve Martin. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1996 interview with Steve Martin. So many comics approach their comedy from an ethnic perspective. There's a long history of, you know, the Jewish comic or, you know, the Jewish dialect comic mm-hmm. or, you know, African-American comics talking about coming of age as an African-American in predominantly white America and so on. Did you ever wish that you had, like, an ethnic slant that you could use in your comedy? Or were you not ever
No.
interested in heading in that direction?
No, not at all. My comedy was much more mental, and I didn't... It was strange because it was physical and mental at the same time. It was almost conceptual sometimes. So that wouldn't have done me any good. And that comedy exists in the real world, and my comedy didn't.
Yeah, that's interesting. What do you mean by that, about it not existing in the real world?
Well, it doesn't. I always thought of my comedy character, such as it was, as a person who was totally isolated and who had to, in a sense, redefine the world in order to get by, couldn't be influenced by the outside. He had to deeply believe in every dumb thought that he had. So that's the most sophisticated it's ever gotten. I mean, just saying it to you now, because I never thought about it that much, but kind of looking back. So it wasn't about a person in this world. It was strange. It was about a nutcase in this world. So... Yeah, go ahead.
No, I'm wondering, when you started doing your more physical comedy and the arrow through the head thing and acting kind of like, you know, goofy and ridiculous on stage, was it hard for you to become that persona? I'm wondering if you were, you know, more inhibited off stage, if that kind of physical approach to comedy came natural to you?
Yeah, it came very natural on stage, and it was developed, you know, through a series of performances, and I had the luxury of working all over the country with essentially no one watching. So you could, you know, you could just try things out, and it didn't matter. And I remember reading an interview with Bill Cosby once, and he said the audience wasn't laughing. He said, but I knew something was happening because the waitresses were. And they saw it night after night after night after night. And in a way, you start playing to insiders. And then they tell people. And then pretty soon you have an audience of insiders, which is exactly what you want.
Now, did you have a sturdy enough ego to withstand any rejection you got early on or indifference?
Oh, I was... I don't know how to answer that, because it always hurts. I had some terrible, terrible reviews. I mean, to this day, I can't forgive the writer for saying such horrible things. But, you know, that doesn't really go away. You get very philosophical about it. And actually, it kind of does go away after a while. You just go, well, life goes on, and this too shall pass.
How did you start doing the balloon animals in your act? You said you'd seen some of this in Disneyland by that vaudevillian.
Well, you know, there was a tradition of, you know, magic acts that don't work.
Uh-huh.
And I realized early on I wanted to do that. And then I thought, well, balloon animals, and I'll have balloon animals that don't work. So that's where it came from. It's pretty simple.
And what about putting the fake arrow through your head?
I don't know. There's something so incredibly stupid about it. And, you know, it was a moment, you know. And that's, you know, it's not a major event. It was just part of the act.
And did the excuse me thing originate in your early stand-up years?
Yes. Yeah. That evolved in the... when I was working in the boarding house, and you know, it's just night after night, and pretty soon you just fly off the handle. And you start saying things, and you start last night I said this, and I'm going to write that down. And then you try it again the next night, and you go a little bit further and a little bit further, and pretty soon... you're there.
Do you remember the first time you used it?
I think I was at the boarding house, and I had a whole bit where I would pretend to be an arrogant entertainer and get really mad at the spotlight operator. And I would just go on this, I would just go crazy and end the routine with that, crazy with anger at the spotlight operator.
I think it was after the Smothers Brothers, when you were doing stand-up and you were better known at this point. You did a lot for opening for rock groups.
Yeah.
In concert arenas, was it? Was it that
day? I did all that. It was terrifying because, I mean, Albert Brooks has a great bit where he says he opened for Ritchie Valens once and he was backstage and he hears the audience going, Ritchie, Ritchie, Ritchie. And he starts to go on to open the show and there's a guy backstage who is going to open the curtain. He looks at Albert and says, you better be Ritchie.
So they weren't
exactly
necessarily happy
like
to see you.
No. But I learned quickly that you don't do that.
You don't do what?
You don't open for big rock bands with a small comedy act.
So where did you go?
I went to small clubs. And I places that seated 99 people. And I called David Brenner, who was very hot at the time. And I said, David, how do you make any money in this world? I mean, I'd get paid, you know, $300 a night, and it would cost me $450 to get there and back. And he said he would lease out a club, and he would take the money at the door. And so I said, well, that's what I'll do. So I started going to little clubs and headlining rather than opening, because I understood the audience, no matter how good you did as an opener, they didn't care. They only cared about the headliner. So I decided to play to smaller houses and be a headliner than open the show for larger houses.
I went over there thinking, you know, oh, everyone's going to speak English, no problem. I don't speak a word of French. It's a universal language, so I'll just be able to speak English. So I get off the plane, I get into a taxi. The first indication I'm going to have trouble, I say to the driver, I'd like to go to a hotel, please. The driver turns and goes, je te suis la douleur de soi. What? What is that you're saying? So the first thing you do, this is really dumb. You think this will help. You adopt a French accent. I would like to go to the hotel. So that's nothing. So I went out, I bought a little French phrase book, hoping to memorize little phrases, you know, can I go to the bathroom and things like that. But French is not like Spanish. In Spanish, you can sound it out. It's easy for Americans. You know, every vowel is a syllable. You go, Casa de Pepe. Donde está Casa de Pepe? But French is like, Jeune de la doigt. Luton doigt. What happened? He spoke French. Help him.
Did you ever think that you were going to outgrow some of your comedy, that it would be unseemly after a certain age to do some of the physical comedy that you were doing?
Absolutely. Yeah. And comedy is like, it's an agreement between yourself and the audience that you are funny.
Right.
And you know, that you can get very, very hot, and then that agreement can go away. It can move on. It moves on to other places. You know, right now Jim Carrey's got it. And he is actually really, really funny. But when that magic agreement is kind of severed through time and you say, okay, well, now what are you going to do next? You have to actually be funny. You know, you have to really, really work. And you have to find it some other way than just the newness and excitement of it.
I'm wondering, in your work as a writer and a performer, what you think the mix is of inhibition and exhibitionism, if you know what I mean? A lot of performers strike me as being a very interesting mix of inhibition and exhibitionism, of really wanting to show off, and of, on the other hand, being really shy and very uncomfortable around other people.
Well, I think that entertaining is the excuse to open up. So I feel myself very shy. I mean, when I started out, very shy around people. But as you get comfortable with your friends, you really open up, and that's where comedy comes from, is, you know, going crazy with your friends and then trying to put it on stage. And I know what you mean. There is a kind of quietness that comes, and then maybe because of that quietness, you're compelled to go on stage and let something out and try to be liked, you know.
Steve Martin, recorded in 1996. He's now starring in the David Mamet film, The Spanish Prisoner.